This episode is brought to you by Carbonite, the leader in online backup. Backup your PC or Mac off-site securely and automatically. For a free trial offer plus 2 free months with purchase, go to carbonite.com. Offer code TWIM.
This week on the show, amateurs versus the pros. Who's Fred? And everyone wants their Old Spice. All this on This Week in Media, episode 205. Hey there, boys and girls. We are back with another edition of This Week in Media. I'm your host, Daisy Whitney, and joining me today is my co-host, Tim Street. Hello, Tim. How are you?
Hey, Daisy, doing great.
And how was CTIA last week? I know you went to the wireless show. Did you learn anything fascinating?
I learned that you have to be on your toes at all times at those shows, and it gets a little tiring, you know, walking around pitching HTML5, adaptive bitrate streaming to everyone, and, doing the whole dynamic ad insertion for the iPad dance.
Now, how does that compare to when you were previously at shows just as Tim Street? Now you're going to shows, you know, as Tim Street with MDialogue.
Well, you know, in one way it's a lot easier because I used to be out pitching video series that no one had ever heard of, and they didn't help anyone until they saw a connection. Whereas when I tell people, hey, we can enable you to do pre-rolls, multi-mid-rolls, and geo-targeted interactive overlays on your iPad video, all of a sudden they go, ooh, I can't do that yet. You guys have something that I need. And so that changes the conversation a lot, and it makes it easier knowing that I have this cool thing that people want.
Very cool. I like that. We also have first-time guests. We have Ben and Rafi Fine. They go together. You know, as you can tell from the last name, they're brothers. I still, you know, I've known these guys for like 3 or 4 years. They're still like one and the same person, which I mean that as a compliment in the sense that you guys are inseparable. But that's the whole persona you have. They are internet video stars and just, you know, they do some terrific videos. You might know them for having done the Lost parody videos, and they do these terrific spoiler videos, spoiling 100 movies in 5 minutes, spoiling, you know, what was it, 25 books or 50 books in 3 minutes. They do some great videos. So Ben, Rafi, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us, and we enjoy being the entity of the Fine Brothers.
And so our listeners can get to know you. If you could direct them to one video, your most recent video, or just sort of your favorite, if they're not familiar with you, what would you point people to go check out to get familiar with your work?
I think right now we would send them to the American Idol interactive experience to see how annotations within the YouTube system can work to create experiences that you've never had before with media.
And that is a very cool video. We'll talk about that a little bit later on the show. We're going to go through some news, and then we're going to spend some time just kind of talking about the latest iterations of YouTube and internet video and kind of what it takes to survive. But the good news is that we are sponsored. This Week in Media is brought to you by Carbonite. Now, a few things you should know about Carbonite. It's a backup service, obviously. It backs up your files automatically whenever you connect to the internet. That's everything: photos, music, emails, financial records, office documents, and so on. Very easy to use. You can also use it to recover lost files, restore previous versions of files. Oh my God, everybody needs this. Just over the weekend, I heard from 2 friends separately who were not using backup services and had hard drive crashes. And it's just, you know, there are constant reminders that it's just so vital to be backing up your data frequently, all the time. It's also very affordable. Unlimited backup for your PC or Mac is less than $5 a month or $55 a year, one flat rate. You can try Carbonite for free. Go to carbonite.com and enter the offer code TWIM, which of course is T-W-I-M. If you decide to buy the service after the free trial, you'll get 2 months free with the offer code TWIM. So be sure to sign up for the free trial from the homepage to get the 2 months free. No credit card required for the free trial. Carbonite.com, offer code TWIM. So there you go. We have got a lot of news to cover. So Up first, everyone knows Apple TV came out a few weeks ago, the newest iteration, but now we're starting to see reports from folks that have it and have set it up. DallasNews.com had an interesting story recently kind of looking at it. So I thought it'd be interesting to sort of touch base with some of these various reports about people who have set it up and what they're saying. Interestingly enough, this morning I got an email from a contact of mine in the advertising business at the 4A's kind of talking about the benefits of it, but some of the frustrations with Apple TV. Obviously, there are so many folks who are trying out these new services now, with Google TV having launched just last week. So this report from the Dallas News story talked about some of the benefits, and the reporter, Jim Rossman, said that he had a lot of praise for it, could do a lot of good things. His wife, apparently, is quite facile now at using the Apple TV. Tim, what are you hearing from users in terms of advantages, disadvantages? Have you had a chance to play around with it at all? And, you know, are people even talking about it? As you're out there sort of on the trade show circuit, what's being said about it?
Well, I ordered mine and I got it. I hooked it up. It was a pain in the butt to hook up, just like TiVo, right? You know, TiVo's great once you have it hooked up. Apple TV is not as hard as TiVo to hook up. I mean, it's just a few things that you click in, but you still have to enter in all your, you know, user information, and you've got to connect to your Wi-Fi, and, you know, so it doesn't. It's not like plugging in a TV and it just works. There are some things to do, but once you have it hooked up, you get Netflix. That's all I got to say. You get Netflix. You don't need anything else, although it does have great stuff. You can listen to all your music. You can look at your photos. You can, you know, rent movies from iTunes. I mean, it's great. It's great.
But you have the Roku as well, don't you, Tim?
Yeah.
So what do you prefer? That's what I wanted to ask you. Why is this better?
It's slicker. It's just, you know, it's so, the design of it is just gorgeous. It's absolutely gorgeous. You know, kind of like the way that you have CoverFlow on your iTunes and you can page through your different music choices. It's similar to that. And you can navigate it not only with the remote control that comes with it, but you can use a remote control on your iPhone or on your iPad, which is very, very cool, because you always have your iPhone with you, as opposed to that little remote that you can, you know, any remote. You can never find the remote, but you always know that your phone's in your pocket or your purse, and that's where you go get it. So that's what's really cool. I think right now the biggest takeaway from Apple TV, don't get into the remote control business, because they're done. We're going to control our TVs with our phones.
So here's a question for you. How can I stop it when I'm in the living room on my Mac, my husband goes in there to use the Apple TV, he gets out the little Apple remote, and then my iTunes on my computer turns on and takes over my screen? Because that always happens to me.
You need to sit in a slightly different position.
Oh, that's simple. Okay, I just need to leave the room. Ben, Rafi, what about you guys? I don't know. I mean, first time on the show, we obviously haven't talked about your TV viewing or video viewing setup, so I don't know if you guys are traditional TV viewers, Roku users, Apple TV users. Tell us a little bit about sort of what you use, but also kind of your thoughts and what you're hearing from the folks that you interact with in terms of what's working and what's not working.
Well, I would say, as successful as we are, we're still somewhat starving YouTube stars. So we don't have any of these fancy things at all. And recently, we recently got cable for the first time in years, not because we really wanted it, but because needing to be so caught up with pop culture, there were things we were missing out on by just not having it, and the access is still not perfect for cable online. So we only recently did that, and I think we only even know one person that has an Apple TV. I think for us, if the excitement is coming with Google TV because of being a YouTube partner and being curious as to how that's going to impact, if at all, what YouTubers are able to do, and if there's going to be specific things that allow for better monetization, or who knows what else could be coming with Google TV. So on our side, and some of the people that we know, we're kind of all waiting in the wings to see how Google TV impacts what we're all doing on YouTube. I think that's kind of where we're at.
What's the buzz? What are your fellow cohorts on the YouTube star side of the fence saying about the possibilities with Google TV?
You know, there hasn't been too much information that has come out specifically. I think everyone's hope is the continued hope, even Honor without Google TV, which is the idea of can CPMs actually get higher on YouTube or not, and will the television aspect of it impact that at all?
And I guess with the navigational, you know, system that YouTube still is very, you know, they lean their way towards using, you know, their high top partners and make sure that people kind of get to see them. And if and when Google TV becomes the staple, or any of these devices become staples, I think that in general, the web series community, everybody that's making online video is very interested in how everybody talks about the future being that web series and all online video is going to be on the same devices and right next to top television shows and all these things. It's a matter of time to see which one of these boxes are going to win out. And then what is all of our placement and will it make viewership go up?
Or go down.
Yeah.
Tim, do you have a sense of the impact that a Google TV might or might not have on the creative side of the business?
Well, it depends on what you're talking about in terms of are we talking about the independent creative side of the business or the studio network side of the business?
Well, I guess both, because maybe the impact will be different.
Yeah. I mean, the studios right now and networks have a lot to worry about with Google TV. You know, if you look at anything that's happened over the last 10 years, whether it's the music business, the movie business, you know, you take a look at Blockbuster. Blockbuster let Netflix come in and just totally undermine their business model. And they got into the, you know, mail the CD thing too late. They got into the streaming stuff too late. And now they've filed for bankruptcy. It's really about how do you get into these businesses without totally cannibalizing your current business? Because if you don't do it, somebody else is going to do it. And Or the other thing is you try to figure out a way to prevent them from doing it, like the music business did with Napster. I mean, they were getting beat up horrendously by Napster, and so they sued Napster and eventually, you know, effectively shut Napster down, but the damage was already done. And it was this other guy, what's his name, Steve Jobs or something?
Yeah, how do you pronounce that name?
Yeah, he came up with this wacky thing called iTunes, and that put the genie back in the bottle because it was easier to use than dealing with all these different sites that you might get the right song, you might not get the right song. It's just easier to pay for it and get it and have it on your computer and not have to worry about going finding it. I mean, it's time versus money. If you have a lot of time, you'll go steal. If you don't, you'll pay for it. That seems to be the human nature aspect of all this. And when it comes to Google TV, the networks and the studios have to figure out a way to stop this independent content. And one of those ways might be paying premiums to get delivered faster or to get delivered ahead or to, you know, eventually show up in a space in front of the Fine Brothers, who can't afford an Apple TV, therefore can't afford to be placed in front of a network or a studio.
Do you see that happening, Ben and Rafi? I mean, do you get the sense that there is there a, and this, hey, this is the way the world works, unfortunately, but is there a sense of preferential treatment? And if so, in what ways?
With the studios
versus independent creators.
I think rightfully so. Like it in a sense.
And hold on, who's talking right now? I want our listeners to get to know your different voices.
This is Rafi.
Okay, all right.
I don't
see,
know what.
It's been 3 years. I still can't tell them apart, guys. All right.
I would love somebody to tell us even what is the quality difference of each of our voices. I don't even know. I think, you know, rightfully so, for various reasons, but that, you know, there haven't been that many people online that have really stood out and been making great content and deserve, like, you know, all that preferential treatment. And then on the studio side and company side, they have been really bad at being able to create proper partnerships with the right people that are online that are proving a lot of models and strategies of how to be successful online. And so you basically have on both sides like this odd tug and pull that is like the studio system wanting to try to do it themselves and continuing to fail. And then you have, you know, places like YouTube who are the farthest along at figuring things out for online video, but at the same time are far off because, you know, they're not so much a content company, they're more of a technology company. And so it makes it hard to be able to actually get them to get the proper content out there for people to see and people to start wanting to advertise and wanting to take part in what web video is going to become.
It's resulted in a stigma almost against successful web content as being amateur because it's just such a lack of understanding from all sides. And YouTube perpetuates that from time to time with the way that they're so search-based versus, you know, trying to make content stand out.
Let's talk a little bit more about advertising, especially as it relates to TubeMogul. Now, that's a company that I know everybody here on the show is familiar with, and I think you've all worked with them, right? I mean, is TubeMogul certainly, I know, has tracked the Fine Brothers videos. Tim, have you have they tracked your videos and helped you with distribution in the past?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in the early days, I was posting French Made TV through TubeMogul when they came out and sending it to the different distribution partners that they have. And, you know, their model is to do pay for placement. So you can, if you have a video that's not a spammy video, you can pay them money to get that featured on different pages of different popular websites. So that, you know, as a marketer, if you have something that is a relevant product or service and you want to get your video for that product or service front and center on some different websites, especially on the first day that you post that, that's a great way to do it.
And first day viewership, of course, is very important. There have been a lot of studies about that. The reason I bring up TubeMogul is that the company just raised $10 million in Series B round of funding led by Foundation Capital, and that brings the company's total venture funding so far to $14.5 million. Not bad for a company that kind of started out as sort of being like a distribution assist play, essentially, kind of a spotter for video folks, kind of help them, you know, make their life easier and send their videos to various places. But TubeMogul has expanded a lot, done a lot of research, and in March it launched an ad platform, the Playtime ad platform. And TubeMogul says that since then it has run more than 200 campaigns for brand advertisers, including Procter & Gamble, Unilever, and Microsoft, that have garnered more than 800 million views. Tim, what do you hear about this ad platform?
You know, it's something that people find value in, and you know, from studios to you know, Procter & Gamble, people are using TubeMogul. They're great guys. They understand the space. They've got some stiff competition out there because they're competing against analytics companies like Comscore, and then they're also competing against ad networks that are out there as well. So it'll be interesting to see how they're able to partner with other ad networks, because the ad network that they have is a little bit different from traditional ad networks.
Like a Scan Scout or Brightroll or something.
Right.
And how is it different? Do you know? Can you explain?
Sure. So in the normal web video advertising network model, the network will round up different sites, and those sites will use their technology to do pre-rolls on the videos that play on their websites. So, you know, if you had a sports site and you talked about different sporting events or different things, it would play that pre-roll before your video played. And then they've aggregated all these different sites, and they spread those pre-rolls across all the different targeted sites. With TubeMogul, they may be getting into that as well. I'm not up to date on the latest part of the network, but in the past, what they've done is you've paid them to get your video that you've created that probably isn't a traditional ad, but more of a web video integrated type ad, and you get that video placed on the front page of different websites. So a little bit different in that it's not really a pre-roll, it's its own video.
So, Ben, Rafi, do you guys use TubeMogul? And if so, how do you use it? What are some of the different sort of features and capabilities you've used?
I'll first say that, like, please keep us on track with this because we will get off tangent when it comes to video ad networks. But
I carry a big stick. I'll keep you guys in shape.
Yeah. Well, TubeMogul, they've been great. I mean, yeah, we're the same way. Back when YouTube hadn't stood out as like the place to, you know, basically live for your distribution for the most part, we were uploading and getting seen and being featured by, you know, 20 different sites that were like YouTube. And TubeMogul was a great service for that. They've not really been that for us anymore because we've stopped uploading to multiple sites pretty much. And at literally every day, we still use the analytics. We still always get an email and check and look at it every day of how many views did we get on YouTube specifically. And they're the ones that we look for. We don't.
Why would you look at a TubeMogul analytics versus what's actually your view count if you're looking for total views, or is it that you're getting more refined data?
No, what it is that two things. One, at least right now, YouTube doesn't have a feature to email you daily how many views you got. Okay. So like they don't even provide that. So it's just good to have a lump number sent to you. Like this is how many views you got on YouTube that day. And it also is a breakdown per video. Another thing that you could do it in YouTube, but it's a laborious process on YouTube. You got to click video to video to video to then see their insight versus it just being a quick, easy thing. Here are your top videos today.
Oh, it'll give you because it'll roll up all of your videos over time. So, how much what is your average daily view count?
You know, it depends. We pretty much put out a video a week, but a month. It's anywhere between 2 and 4 million on YouTube.
Not bad. All right.
Yeah. And so I don't know what that comes out daily to. Yeah.
So let's go back to video ad networks. You said that you have some strong opinions on video ad networks. Obviously, ad networks are an important topic and they play a vital role in the online video advertising ecosystem. What are your thoughts on them?
I mean, to try to not go crazy about it, and we understand, you know, the different types of models that are out there, and especially when you're dealing with brand and entertainment, that there's certain impression, you know, numbers you have to hit and things like that, which is the way we see these things should be more properly used. But it's really the difference between actual sustained, engaged viewership that actually is something that people are watching and coming back to watch versus completely, essentially,
a commercial
that is the equivalent of you don't know who watched it. It's not the same person every time. I went and bought ad time just like I bought an ad on a popular website. It's like I bought an ad on The Biggest Loser on TV. X amount of millions of people might have seen it, quote unquote, but really none of them really saw it at all. And I don't. But the problem becomes when people that are running these campaigns, especially if it isn't necessarily branded, and are touting their show as this gigantically huge successful show with multi-millions of views, when the reality is if they stopped using the ad network, their viewership would go down to zero. We always want to see analytics of, okay, well, if 5 million impressions were seen on that episode of something, how many of the next 5 million impressions on the next episode were the same people? Because that would build a case study to show you, is this show actually successful or are you just buying commercials? And if they talked about it like commercials and said it was a commercial and blah, we wouldn't care as much.
And I think that that's the thing, is that there's a difference between branded entertainment and actual original content. Because if it's branded entertainment, then you can be successful in a way to be just like you buy a commercial on television, that buying a commercial on the internet is kind of, you know, having a banner ad and you put your video in that, and that's an impression, just like a commercial on television is that. But when it's an actual original piece of content, you need way more like data and legitimacy to actually tout that you have a successful show or a successful brand online. And that's why we've become such advocates of YouTube in a way, because they have built such an amazing subscriber system where you have these people that do come back every video and are engaged with your content versus these other places that are just talking about how they have all these millions of views. When you go to their content, they have zero comments, they have no engagement, nobody anywhere on the Twitter sphere, on Facebook, on Google search, if you even look to see who's talking about these shows and these videos from some people, nobody's talking about them because nobody's actually watching them. They might even be on mute and auto-played on these ad networks across these websites.
Okay, so this is a beautiful philosophical debate, and I love it. So a question to you. You talked about how you know, an advertiser can run a campaign for branded entertainment. You know, let's say a soap company produces a whatever, a cute little 5-episode scripted series. I don't know. Totally making this up. Push it out through an online video ad network, gets 5 million views. Now, is there, I'm going to throw this to Tim, but what the Fine Brothers are saying is, you know, that's a little bit of gaming the system, whereas it's not building an audience. But I guess I wonder, I can see their point of view, but for an advertiser, does it matter? Are they trying to grow an audience like a content creator is trying to do?
What really matters is the return on the investment. So if you're going to spend money with a YouTube partner, are you going to get people to come see your movie? If you spend money on an ad network, are you going to get people to come see your movie? And right now, unfortunately for us in the web video space, we still have trouble getting people to do something on a mass scale. Now, it's easy to do a TV buy and get people to come see your movie. That happens. You know, you can definitely correlate that. And it's happening less and less. But it's still hard for the web video space for us to really motivate that stuff. Now, I can show you different cases where there are some big, there are some small success stories where there have been return on investments that have come through. But for the most part, it's hard to point to, like, people know YouTube and they've heard of YouTube, but if you walked up to somebody on the street and you said Fred, they probably don't know what Fred is. Their kids would, but they wouldn't know what Fred is. And we still have that hurdle in front of us, is that the same problem that the studios and networks are facing with death by a thousand cuts, we're also, even though we're creating the cuts, we have the same problem.
So, Ben and Rafi, do you buy that? How do you prove ROI to the different advertisers that you have worked with? How does a Michael Buckley, a Shane Dawson, a Fred, folks like that, prove that, you know, that folks are listening and responding?
Well, I mean, we pretty much agree with what Tim said in terms of there really isn't mass scale ROI going on, even with these top people. I think part of it is still a disconnect on how to properly leverage these personalities and how to make content that's going to speak to the audience in a different way than just, and a lot of it, and it, you know, this again varies on different opinions out there. We think a lot of the so-called gaming the system has hurt a lot of the brand relationships that anybody has, especially inside of YouTube, where some of these people are more personalities that talk to camera, that instead of trying to do something clever and unique and create something that would be perceived as cool when you have an audience that is so dedicated to a person, it's become instead like, I'm going to pay you money that is not nearly as much money as I would pay something else to completely just hawk my product blatantly and get all of my messaging across, because I don't really know if I'm going to get ROI. I don't really know if the views are real. And so I just want all my messaging to get across, and you can get me all the views that I need, and I'll go to someone that has a huge audience so I can just hit my impression number, not necessarily with an ad buy. We kind of believe in merging the two, where, you know, you can prove that there's engagement because the comments are there. You know, there's thousands of them versus anywhere else. We'd like to see a future where if you have an audience that is sustained and you can see it and prove that, like, real views are coming back every single time to something, that you can do some type of a more banner sponsorship similar to even this show, and that we really like even seeing, to then try to create an experience where you're being able to do something bigger or cooler because you're getting help from a brand or a sponsor that's helping you on your show. And we then look at and take it further to be like, then create a piece of content for that brand that lives in their world. So it isn't you having to live it on yours. You're able to make something that is unique, speaks to your audience, is cool. Maybe it's about a movie. And then you're able to say, oh, and guess what? They had me go to the red carpet and interview the star of that movie. And you can see that video over at their website or over at their YouTube, which then builds a brand identity for them to the audience that already is there online. And if they're trying to reach that demographic, they're ripe for the taking, especially on YouTube with these people that are command such a high audience that could drive people at least over to them to see it. At that point, though, you still run the question of, well, how many people actually went to the movie, and then is that valuable?
Now, so is that message starting to resonate with the brands that you're talking to? I mean, that's obviously part of your pitch, it sounds like. Well, how do brands receive the message that you have to share with them?
you know, it depends on the brand. I think some are more interested in I think it also depends how much money they have. Some are willing to kind of play and experiment a bit right now because they are seeing, especially in the last 6 months, you know, a lot of articles have come out that are really starting to shine a spotlight on some of these top YouTubers that have, you know, cable-sized audiences. And all, even though it's been that way for a little while, all of a sudden people are taking notice, so they're trying to play and figure out different ways. For the most part, though, brands are still coming with small amounts of money to just get you to make a blatant advertisement for them. And for the, and the other problem, even on the YouTuber side, is a lot of YouTubers get excited about the idea of interviewing a celebrity, and versus it being on their terms, like, oh no, let me use a celebrity in a video, and will it be cool, and then I'll promote the other thing. Instead, it becomes a brand coming and saying, hey, you can, this is an actor that you love, go and interview them for free and promote me. And a lot of them do it, which then causes problems throughout the entire ecosystem because of how they know that they can find somebody that will do it for a low rate or for nothing.
I'd say the hope is just a time factor, that over time and more case studies and more analytics continue to come. And I think that that's one of the big things that everybody's talking about, is needing more, you know, transparency and discrepancy. And that you, I think what all of us have been talking about for a long time is that the that big ad buy and the value of the internet is how niche demographic you can get, and that you'll be able to slowly but surely be able to target things much better, and hopefully case studies will come out that, like, you shouldn't just pay a random person on YouTube or somebody that has a giant audience this random amount of money that they're not going to be able to do something good for your brand, and that you'll actually find the proper ways that actually will possibly give you ROI or whatever you're looking for. Because that's what's also exciting for some people online, is the branded entertainment experiences, and that you can get these commercials out there in a completely different way that, like, Old Spice can online. It's a whole new form of media. Even new media has this whole great thing of branded entertainment as well, but it's resulting in us having to be very careful and specific, and allowing for various companies and people out there to take advantage of it right now until we figure it out a bit more.
Let me play devil's advocate for just a second. Obviously, I love your work. As you know, that's how we, you know, got in contact in the first place, because I've really enjoyed all of your videos. But for the folks who are listening to this who might work at media agencies or ad agencies at much bigger entities than Daisy Whitney Inc., we're thinking, okay, you guys get 4 million views a month. I mean, that's great and that's good. But, you know, this sounds like, you know, the rallying cry of, you know, a YouTuber who just wants to, you know, make a better living. Like, what is it that, how do you leap beyond that, so that, you know, so that you're taken more seriously, so that others are taken more seriously?
Brands should be realizing that they need an engaged audience around the content that they're making, if that is something that they want. If they want their own Old Spice, which it feels like everybody does want that, they're seeing that success. That was an engaged, you know, viewership thing that you could see from all the comments and engagement in Twitter and Facebook
that they now can have for any campaign they move forward with from now.
Yeah, and so, you know, that's kind of is the difference, that it's not, it's, if you want to create something unique and that actually is going to get people talking that could do well for your brand's credibility on the internet, or do you just, you know, looking to make something that you can say got all of these numbers online, but really no one watched it, really? It becomes just, it's not so much, it's not really much make a living. It's like, let's create something to make us legitimate in terms of as content creators, and how to utilize brand sponsorships in a new way with new media.
And I can't help but just say one more thing, which is that, and the bigger problem also is it becomes the plight of people, you know, that have a real audience online, because there are major companies and studios out there that are completely lying about their type of viewership and getting a lot of money to create the content that they are, but they're utilizing these techniques that are, you know, showing off not real viewership for their original content.
Tim, what do you hear from that front? Is that the case in the market? Are a lot of brands just getting impressions that don't actually matter, and that are just kind of racked up impressions that at the end of the day don't translate into anything?
It just depends on if your boss is paying attention or not.
Right. Isn't that true, though?
You know, yep. if you can show a spreadsheet with all these views that you got on the internet, great. If you can show what you bought on TV, great. If you can show what you bought on radio, great. But if you have a boss that's looking at the numbers and looking at what money came in because of that. You can't track radio and TV as well as you can the internet, especially if you're selling something online and driving somebody to online. If you're just looking for brand awareness, different ball game. But if you're looking to move the needle, if you're looking to do that, you can really track that with the web videos. And one of the things that like a little tip for some of those brands out there, a lot of times they'll spend money on a web video, but they won't put that web video on their own site. And if they want to really, you know, come about this in a synergistic way, stick that video on their own site so that it drives more traffic to that video, jacks up the numbers on YouTube, and gets even more people to see it.
Why because do you think they neglect that aspect of it?
Because they think that they're paying like a time buy. They think that they're doing something where they don't want to cannibalize their own web traffic, when in reality they're not cannibalizing it. They're giving a shot in the arm to that video to get it going. And even if they just stuck it there for the first 1 or 2 days, if their website has a lot of traffic, it just reinforces their brand. It gives them something, but it also helps that video do better on YouTube so that those numbers go up and more people, you know, you look at a video, go, oh, it has 300 views. You look at a video, go, oh, it has 300,000 views and it just got put on today. I'm going to watch this. It looks like a hot video.
Tim, do you think that there are a lot of creators who are sort of willing to work for free for brands? I mean, that's something that Ben and Rafi kind of touched on. You know, these guys are obviously in a certain tier of creators who are successful and who are able to, you know, to kind of make a living off of YouTube and their videos. Are there folks underneath that who, in a way, might be, you know, hampering more established YouTubers?
That's always going to be there.
Right.
There, you know, that's just there. And what you have to do as a content creator is build something of value so that your audience is extremely valuable compared to somebody else who's willing to do it for free. You know, how long will they be willing to do it for free? In some cases, forever, just because they like it. They enjoy the fame. They don't have to worry about paying their rent. You can't pay your rent yet with YouTube video views. Maybe someday you will, but right now you can't. So you got to figure out some way to monetize it. And what I'm really curious about from you guys is right now there's a trend on YouTube to where different YouTubers are banding together and creating almost like little networks. You've got Lisa Nova with The Station. You've got Black Box TV. What do you guys think about that stuff that's going on?
Well, disclosure, we were the head of production and head of creative at The Station for most of this year, but we transitioned out in July. So we were very, very involved with what was going on over there. For the most part, it's the system inside of YouTube that is what also, I think, makes YouTube this interesting place for creativity, that you're in a spot where, for the most part, if you're doing something unique or cool, or you end up meeting some of these people and click with them, there's the opportunity to get discovery, you know, essentially via, if you look at them as celebrities or you look at them as their own networks, you have a chance to like be like, okay, cool, I did something that made me stand out, and now this conglomerate of people think I'm great and want to now point people to my content. So it's becoming almost a, I wouldn't go so far as to call it United Artists system, but it's kind of like a micro United Artists system of people that want to help each other because you can make each other grow, which I think also has become, there's always been collaborations inside of YouTube, but it's becoming a little more formalized because there is business models that can work even with the low CPMs inside of YouTube.
Well, how do you do that? How do you partner with these people? What are some different partnership business models that you've seen among the YouTubers? Because most of these people aren't really business people. So, I mean, do you create a YouTube channel and then split it on a percentage basis? How do you account for the views that are coming from your site versus their site?
It gets very, very complicated.
It gets complicated, and also at least for now, we have to. It's interesting of how we have to talk about it because of the knowledge we have and some NDA stuff that we have. But I think everything that you just said is up in the air. There are various companies now that I think because YouTube has now become a place that you can build a company, you can start building companies off of. You have, you know, a Maker Studios, which is The Station. You have Next New Networks. You have The Collective. You have Black Box TV falls under Philip DeFranco's business, basically. And so you have different people that are being able to... It's not... Again, just like us, and we're one of the few people that can just, like, get by, like, living off of YouTube. And there are now companies that are being able to just get by off of YouTube. And so it's sprouting up different business models of how do you build other channels? How do you, if you're popular, how do you start making somebody else popular and then reap revenue and benefits off of that fact? And build your own, just like Black Box TV is, a horror channel. How do you now make your own niche demographics so that you can then be catering to different companies out there?
I think the models, for the most part, deal with if, and some don't operate with hub channels like the station. Some are all individual channels. But when you have something like that, the idea is bringing everybody together. And there's varying models on how revenue is split on that hub, but then going out, part of it is a give and take where it's like you're part of this bigger thing that's going to result in potentially getting bigger ad dollars that can be split between everybody. And in the process, there's going to be promotion targeted to all of you from being part of this collective unit. So it becomes a whole strategy of cross-promotion that you then bring around that kind of shares the wealth with everybody, with then the carrots being things like trying to band together to get higher CPMs as a network. And or getting bigger brand opportunities because you can spread it across a network and assure them more impressions. That, again, going back to the other point, that we hope the separation between, you know, ad network views and engaged, sustained viewership will hope, you know, if you have a bunch of people that you can say, we can get you a 2 or 3 million views in a week across our network, and it's engaged, and we can show you that it's engaged, and we can show you the analytics, you can then potentially command a higher price point and then share that with everybody.
I want to go back to the comments that we talked about earlier. Now, comments on YouTube, do those prove engagement? Because I'm sort of two minds. I can see your point that compared to other sites, somebody clicking that they liked a video, giving it a thumbs up, or leaving a comment, you know, shows that at least they were a real person who was there. But the comments also are just kind of a place for craziness too, right?
Well, I think you just hit it, like, and maybe, like, that even makes me, because of how you've just responded to how we use the word engagement, I would say that I use it as a tool to actually prove that there are people there. I think it's more of that for me. I don't think we've gotten to the point where, like, you're going to go, hey, guys, like, let me know in the comments if you bought deodorant from Old Spice. And then you're specifically, like, making them prove via Blippi or, you know, Foursquare or I don't know what, that, like, you're actually proving that they paid it. And that's actually, like, showing a full, real, like, transparent engagement.
Or that they said anything other than OMG or something right. That I can't say on the show.
Well, yes, there are trolls that you cannot believe, but that's the problem a little bit on YouTube, and YouTube's own system that is hurting itself is that they're so algorithmically based, is that a lot of these vloggers on YouTube and personalities on YouTube are able to exploit the comment section of having people just respond randomly to various things and leave a comment just to satisfy their algorithm so that they can get the most comments so that they'll show up hopefully on the homepage, because that's how YouTube works now. There's no editorial. It's all based on how many comments, thumbs up, you know, video responses you get. So these YouTubers end up exploiting those things to their viewers where they just, and I think even the viewers are now led to understand that to a point where, like, the comments don't mean a ton, but what they do mean, at least to us going out there, is that, like, this shows that people are actually there. There's a percentage that will comment on videos on any website that you go to that actually has true legitimate traffic and a fan base and viewership. They have people that are commenting on their videos.
So it's interesting. It just shows that there is value to the comments. It's sort of like maybe a first line of defense in having conversations with advertisers, that, you know, that the comments show that, you know, that there is a significant difference between viewership and interactions here as opposed to places where it is purely autoplay or something is muted. Now, I have a final question for the panel, and then we need to wrap things up. We've talked about CPMs on YouTube and that they're notoriously low. Tim, are they ever going to go up to the point where creators are happy?
That's a good question. It's hard to say. You know, YouTube's always been a tough place for advertisers to spend money because they're worried about their brand. They're worried about what content they're going to be next to. They're worried where they're going to show up. And I think that's a hurdle. I've also noticed recently, and this could have been there for a while, but I just didn't see it. Now when you upload a video to YouTube, there's a checkbox for you to check if your video has paid product placement in the video itself. Has that been there for a long time, guys?
It's been there now for a while because initially part of the partner program agreement was you were not allowed to do that, which caused an uproar. So that's been there now, I think, for a year, somewhere around there. And that by doing that, you then will not get any advertisements on those videos to not cause conflicts of interest.
Because that's where you had companies like HitViews that were coming in and pairing brands with creators and kind of looping YouTube out. And that's where YouTube said, whoa, if you're going to be hosting this video on our site and there's an ad built in, we want a cut of that.
Initially, yes. And then it became a problem of you know, those types of videos also having ads on it. So then it became conflict of interest for brands. When what if like a competing video game system was advertising against, you know, a competitor? Like,
and that's why I think you have I think like the company that most people know that still utilizes YouTube completely, though not using letting YouTube serve ads, is Revision 3. If you go to any of the people that are under their banner, they have the inside their videos is, you know, to Netflix or to GoDaddy and stuff, and they won't put any ads in their videos. There is of course the problem though that there are YouTubers and the partners are not adhering to these things, and they'll end up getting paid to make a product placement video, and they'll still want to get the extra money, mm-hmm. and they'll let ads be on there, and that's part of YouTube having to police their partners a bit more.
Lots of interesting stuff going on. Looks like we're near the end of the show. This has been a fascinating discussion. I hope our listeners have enjoyed it. I have really enjoyed hearing all of you guys kind of weigh in on the opportunities and challenges on YouTube and making money as an online video creator. So I just want to thank Ben and Rafi for being on the show. I want to remind our listeners to become our friend on the TWIM Facebook page, facebook.com/pages/thisweekinmedia. Tim, where can people find you online?
You can find me at 1TimStreet. Or at MDialogue.
Excellent. Ben and Rafi, where do you want people to find you?
You can find us on YouTube at youtube.com/TheFineBros and across all the social networks also /TheFineBros because we're an entity. We're never individuals.
That's right. They're like fused together, their brains and their thoughts. They only have one. They only use one earbud anyway. if you're looking for me, Daisy Whitney, you can find me at daisywhitney.com and Daisy Whitney on Twitter. As most of you know, my novel, The Mockingbirds, is coming out in 3 weeks. Yay, November 2nd. So you can pre-order it on Amazon. And actually, I want to let our listeners know that this is my second to last show for a little while. I'm going to be taking some time off in November and December to focus on some other projects. So Alex will probably be helming the show then. I'm sure I'll be back next year, but just wanted to let people know. Of course, I always love chatting with listeners. Listeners can always email me, daisywhitney@gmail.com, or find me on Twitter at daisywhitney. And next week, David Bloom will be hosting, and then I'll be back on October 26th. This mess you've been listening to was recorded on October 12th, 2010. We are over and out.
This Week in Media is a PixelCore.tv production produced by Suzanne Llewellyn with technical producers John Riley and Alutha Jamankar. Content contributor is Jason Perrier.